We
are.
We
are.
We are cultivate.
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 We are cultivate.
Hello and welcome to Yule Crime, where we discuss the funny, strange, and obscure crimes of yesteryear. I'm your host, Lindsay Valenti, and joining me today is Philip Gibbons of the Bite-Sized Biographies podcast, and I'm going to give him an opportunity to tell us a little more about his show before we dive into today's topic.
Well, thanks, Lindsay, and it's a pleasure to be here, and it's nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Yes, my podcast is entitled Bite-Sized Biographies. The official title is much longer, but you can find me on Apple at BYTE, Bite-Sized Biographies. It's basically a history biography podcast about kind of the famous, the infamous, and the quirky. And I get into everybody from Michelangelo to Bernard Madoff to Ray Kroc, who started McDonald's, to Billie Holiday, to Jack Johnson, the boxer. And I probably have 100 plus episodes right now. There should definitely be something of interest to everybody. Another good one is Bob Marley. So if you're into that kind of music and that story, which is an amazing story, then you should find that interesting.
Yeah. So what got you interested in like history?
Well, even from a young age, I was a history major in college, but I love to read. And for whatever reason, you know, some people just think history is really boring, but I always equated it with dramatic stories, and I think that's kind of where the podcast came from, because I think especially in biography, there's so many amazing stories out there that people, for instance, one of my podcasts is Edgar Allan Poe, and most people have heard of him.
Sure.
But his life, even though he only lived to be 39, his life was both amazing and yet bizarre, and a lot of it is just really unknown to people. So I'm not only a history buff, but I take an interest in those really sort of very obscure aspects of even very famous people's lives.
Yeah, I think that's something where we have that in common. You know, our show focuses on lesser known crimes throughout history and, you know, like quirky and obscure and bizarre things. And basically the things that you don't learn about in history class is essentially kind of what we cover. So I definitely understand your, what's the word I'm looking for?
Interest.
Behind the scenes of different people and things like that, like the things that you just wouldn't know without doing tons of research on your own, which is kind of the beauty of podcasts, is being able to listen to somebody else's research so you don't have to do it by yourself.
So that's kind of what got me here. You know, we have a specific story we want to talk about today. And if you'd like, maybe we should just get on with it.
Yeah, for sure. So we connected because you reached out to discuss the 1875 American-sponsored voyage of the Catalpa to rescue some Irish political prisoners from the Fremantle jail in Western Australia. And I had never heard of this, so I am super interested to hear what you have to say on this topic.
And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because my wife and I were on an ocean cruise. And of course, on any ocean cruise, you go anywhere, you're always going to run into Australians. I was telling the story to them, and they both even worked in the Australian government, and they also had never heard the story. And they were stunned to hear it. And it's not only a fascinating story, but it's exciting. And I may be jumping ahead of myself a little bit, but recently I did read that they are talking about developing a Netflix drama over this.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of an introduction. Yeah, an American-produced network drama. So it's really kind of wild and also very cinematic. It starts in Ireland, in the sense that, you know, Ireland, especially during the Victorian era, wasn't really happy about being a British crown colony. So every once in a while, they would stage some kind of a revolt or rebellion. And the kind of sad thing about Irish history is the Irish pretty much lost every military battle they got involved with over hundreds of years. And many of even their revolts, because the British did such a great job of infiltrating any of the military that served in Ireland. By the way, 30% of the British army occupying Ireland was Irish, because it was a good paycheck. But a lot of those soldiers weren't really loyal to Britain. They were Irish. So in this particular case, in 1866, a whole bunch of people, civilians mostly, but also military people, soldiers serving in the British Army, got arrested in advance of what they planned to be a national revolt. And unfortunately for seven of those people, they were sentenced to hang. And even in those times, hanging political prisoners, even the British were pretty harsh on that. But in Europe, there was a lot of pushback, and especially in America, where there was already a really vocal Irish population that was politically influential. Finally, the British decided instead, okay, we'll commute the sentences of these seven prisoners, but we'll send them to a penal colony in Australia, which, again, your listeners may not be aware, but in Victorian England, a lot of folks who were just common criminals, the way the British dealt with them was, especially if they were habitual criminals, is they just put them on a boat and they sent them to Australia. And not only just to Australia, they imprisoned them in what were usually extremely remote and really harsh conditions. And in the case of the last ship that actually was sent to Australia with Irish prisoners was the ship that contained the seven formerly condemned men. And they wound up, as you mentioned, they called it the Fremantle Goal, or nicknamed the Establishment. And it's actually a UN heritage site today because it was such a massive and also historic building. But the seven men were placed in cells that were 3 by 7 by 9 feet in solitary confinement. So their conditions were especially harsh. Yeah. And if you look, you can find pictures. I mean, I have a website at someveryfamouspeople.com, but you can find the Fremantle Goal. There are pictures of it even today. And you can imagine as a prison, even though now it looks all spruced up with a nice green lawn in front of it, must have been an incredibly harsh situation to be imprisoned in. So the only good news for these folks and a lot of the people who were in this jail was because they were so far away from the British Isles, they were 10,000 miles away by boat. Nobody had a boat to escape. And they were 3,000 miles away from Western Australia. So they would have had to have traversed the Australian outback, which was impossible. And they probably would have been captured if they got maybe 20 miles outside of the jail. They pretty much had the run of the town of Fremantle, because they were also assigned to work details to do farming. And this is an important part of the story, because had they been just locked up in these solitary confinement cells, this escape probably never would have been possible.
Sure.
And the first interesting thing that happened was, as far as these prisoners, was one of the seven in 1871, a guy named John O'Reilly, because they, and you love these Irish names, but this guy basically, another interesting thing was the Australians and British supervisors and even infrastructure that ran this prison and the penal colony, again, didn't have a problem with any of the Irish Catholics who were in the prison attending mass at an external Catholic church.
Okay.
And it turned out a priest was an Irish sympathizer to the cause of Irish nationalism, which is also important, because he helped one of these prisoners, a guy named John O'Reilly, in 1871, with a little bit of money and a little bit of kind of intervention, he got a whaling captain, because that part of Australia, the South Pacific near there, was whaling grounds. He got a whaling captain on a U.S. ship, basically by giving him a few dollars. This guy also was sympathetic. He said, look, if we can get this prisoner to your ship, will you take him back to America?
Sure.
And this ship, which was called the Gazelle, this captain agreed to do that. And so this guy, John O'Reilly, made the trip. He escaped from the prison because, again, nobody was really keeping an eye on this guy on a daily basis. He was able to get a couple of Confederates to row him out to the ship. And basically that ship took him back to the United States. Well, when he got there, there was a whole group of Irish people, including another individual by the name of John Devoy, who had escaped from an Irish prison in Dublin.
Okay.
By the way, once you escaped from prison in Ireland, the first thing you did was try to figure out how to get to the U.S. because if the British caught you, they were probably again going to then send you to Australia.
Yeah, that or worse, put you to death.
So this guy, John Devoy, immediately after he got to the U.S., he tried to meet with O'Reilly to ask him, look, there's six other people who were left behind there. Now, the Irish priest I mentioned also smuggled out a letter to the Irish community in the U.S. because what started to happen was there was a liberal government under, well, the prime minister's name was Gladstone. And all these penal colonies, again, it was the last ship that ever got there. And what the British started to figure out was, running these penal colonies basically that really just existed to punish these people started to get to be really expensive.
Oh, yeah, I imagine.
And so they started a lot of the civilian prisoners with the proviso that they couldn't come back to either Ireland or, you know, the British Isles.
Okay.
So what they did, a lot of these prisoners, was they went to Eastern Australia, like Sydney or Melbourne, or they went to the United States.
Okay.
And so this was kind of important because they got word back to the Irish community in the United States that, and also a letter from this Irish priest from the prisoners, the political prisoners, the military ones, where they said, hey, they let out some of these people, but they will never let us out. And you know, this is, even though they let us, you know, we have the run of the town during the day, these are still really harsh conditions. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about getting even tougher on the political prisoners who remain behind, because there's going to be a smaller group of people here. So this guy, John Devoy, basically decided in speaking with O'Reilly that the way to get these six prisoners out, really the only way, was to finance their own expedition and basically buy their own ship that was the SS Catalpa, that was essentially a whaling ship. And they hired a captain by the name of George Smith Anthony from New Bedford, Mass., financed him getting hired. His father-in-law actually was also in New Bedford, was a big shot of the whole whaling industry. And he was sympathetic, although he wasn't Irish. And so he actually fronted a lot of the money with the promise that eventually they would pay him back. And
that's cool.
Smith Anthony, though, was going to disguise this as a whaling expedition. And he didn't want to tell any of the crew members, save for the first mate of the ship, a gentleman by the name of Sam Smith, what they were really up to, for several different reasons. One being probably it would be hard to get a crew. And the other being that basically the word might get out that they were actually coming to Australia, and especially if some of these crew members deserted, which was fairly common on whaling expeditions, even without something of this nature. So the good news was they made it across to the Canary Isles, okay, which is a, you know, an island group that before you head down and went around Africa and head to Australia, usually you stop in there and get replenished. It's kind of off the coast of Portugal, near to Africa as well. And it was fairly, still today even, it's a fairly common place for ships to stop in,
sure,
but especially in those days. And so the good news, they got to the Canary Islands with no problem. And they had about $12,000 worth of whale oil and whale products that they had harvested along the way. But the bad news was five of the ship's crew deserted, which wasn't unusual. As soon as they got some money, they usually packed it in. And to give you an idea how dangerous whaling expeditions were in those days, one of the crew members was actually killed, which is awful, but not particularly uncommon. So basically, Smith Anthony had to replenish the crew, get the ship up and running again, and then they set off for what they told everyone on the ship was whaling grounds off of the western coast of Africa. Well, that was relatively profitable, but then all of a sudden Smith Anthony then basically told the crew that, well, we really should try the South Pacific, and there was a little bit of grumbling, but most of the people on the ship, the way this normally worked was you committed for about a year on these ships. That's why some people deserted, because they couldn't take a year. So the first chance they got, they basically got off the ship.
Sure.
And Anthony was able to convince the crew to head to Southern Australia. By the way, at the same time, John Devoy had two Confederates that he had also sent from San Francisco and New York. One guy's name was John Breslin, and the other guy's name was Tom Desmond. He was from San Francisco. Breslin was from New York, because both Devoy and Smith Anthony knew that they would need help on the ground, somebody to organize breaking these people out of the jail. It would be impossible for him as a ship captain to coordinate something like that. And so they needed somebody to get involved. And the good news about Breslin was he was masquerading as a wealthy investor. And he wasn't, the whole plan was to keep away from Desmond while they were in Perth and Fremantle. But Breslin was able to ingratiate himself. And anytime anyone who smelled the money showed up, especially an American, everybody in that part of Australia really welcomed them because they were enthusiastic. There really wasn't a lot of industry going on there.
Sure. Yeah.
And so Breslin not only got to tour the Fremantle goal, he also hooked up with the Irish priest who had helped O'Reilly escape, because they had to plan on the ground how exactly they were going to get this done. And The real problem then for Breslin was he had to wait for Smith Anthony, because Smith Anthony had to sail from the Canary Islands all the way to Western Australia. And he was scheduled to show up in January of 1876. And the only way that Breslin would know that he got there was if they received a notification of an arriving ship, the Catalpa, at any one of the telegraph offices in either Perth or Fremantle.
Okay.
And there was no other way to really communicate. And so for a solid 2 months, Breslin just sat there, and he had no idea. I mean, there was no internet, obviously, no telephone,
sure.
No way for the Catalpa to communicate with him other by this very rudimentary manner. And so mm-hmm. It wasn't until March 28th that basically Smith Anthony's ship, the Catalpa, at a local telegraph office, Breslin was able to see that basically it was in port. Now, the really good news for this mission was that once they heard that there was an American whaler in the vicinity, everybody in Australia got all excited about introducing Smith Anthony to Breslin, not knowing that they were actually Confederates with a completely different mission.
Sure.
And not only did Smith Anthony and Breslin meet up and plan their logistics, but Breslin also got Smith Anthony on board a ship called the Georgette, which was a British ship. It was kind of a quasi-police ship that cruised along the waters off of Fremantle and Perth. And even though it was more of a passenger ship and a cargo ship, it also had at least one artillery piece on it. So
Okay. Should
there be any kind of local kind of criminal behavior, the Georgette had the ability to basically step in and stop any of that kind of thing.
Sure.
The problem for the Catalpa was, because the Catalpa was basically a 90-foot whaling ship, it had no means to resist even that kind of, you know, not particularly well-armed vessel. And in fact, it would only take a couple of artillery shells from the Georgette to sink the Catalpa.
Okay.
So basically, they had to be wary of that ship. And the other problem they had that was, it was something they couldn't predict, but another British ship called HMS Conflict had also docked, which was normal, but it just would take a while. But it had been cruising in the South Pacific as you know, the British Navy basically went all over the world. And so that British naval ship was in Fremantle and Perth for at least 10 days. So they couldn't think of trying to pull off the escape, because this ship would hunt down the Catalpa in no time and either sink it or take everybody prisoner. It was one thing to try to outrun the Georgette. It would be impossible for them to try to escape from a British warship like the Conflict. So everybody sat tight. But in the meantime, the third element of this was that Breslin would also attend Catholic Mass. And one of the good things for these prisoners were, even though they were confined to solitary confinement by night, during the day, they kind of had the run of the town and various work assignments, or they were allowed to attend Catholic Mass off-site.
Sure.
At a church where this very kind of sympathetic Irish priest conducted Mass, and he was in cahoots with Breslin, and they were able to signal kind of to these six prisoners, first of all, that an escape was imminent, that there was a ship available. Breslin would return with an exact date and more information through the Irish priest when he was able to set that up with George Smith Anthony.
Okay.
Between Smith Anthony and Breslin, they decided another sort of happenstance that was coincidental but worked out really well for them was that Easter Sunday was approaching. And Easter Sunday was a huge holiday. And even the day after Easter Sunday in Western Australia was a huge holiday where the entire citizenry pretty much of Fremantle would head to Perth for a regatta. And so a lot of the people who might have been on the lookout for such a thing wouldn't even be in town. The only people would be there would be kind of the unfortunate staff that didn't have the time off or weren't able to get the day off.
Yeah, like the junior staff.
Exactly. And the other thing is they would have had Sunday off, so they would have been partying it up. And so the next day they'd be half asleep early in the morning, which was when they were going to coordinate this breakout. Because what essentially happened was, on that Easter Sunday, George Smith Anthony, five other crew members, got into the whale boat, which on a whaler, there's both the whaling ship itself, which again, in this case was 90 feet long, but they also had a long boat, which you would basically use once you were in the vicinity of any whales. You'd have to chase down these whales and harpoon them. So every one of these whalers had this kind of a longboat that was usually about 20 to 25 feet long. Also had a small sail on it. The other thing that they had also taken care of was because of O'Reilly's escape, the Australian authorities, anytime a ship was leaving Australian waters, customs had to go on board that ship, and they wouldn't release the ship until they had searched the ship entirely to make sure there was nobody on the ship that shouldn't be there, i.e. a prisoner of Fremantle Gold. They had already done that. They had already basically, they were now kind of anchored off of this town of Rockingham. And the plan that Breslin and his friend also put, or his confederate also put into place with actually four other local people who were Irish sympathizers lined up the priests, was two of those men were going to cut the telegraph cables between Fremantle and Perth, and also Fremantle and the southern villages that they were heading to, i.e. this town, which was called Rockingham, and other small villages. And two of the other people that were involved in the plot were basically going to ride ahead of Breslin and Pendleton, who basically were going to have carriages in which they would take these three on each carriage and take them to a spot on the beach where the longboat was going to then pick them up and take them back to the ship. And it seems, I don't know, it seems like it would be fairly simple, except there were a lot of things. And by the way, I'm sorry, Breslin's confederate's name was Desmond. So it was Breslin and Desmond who were going to be on these wagons.
Okay.
Now, the other tricky part was to get the six prisoners out of prison and out of their work details and basically get them to, you know, this rendezvous point, which was going to be Breslin and the wagons that were going to take them on the Rockingham Road, which was a solid 20 miles away and a good 2 hours away by, because even though it was a horse-drawn carriage, basically those, you know, it's not like it's a Porsche or something like that that can go 70 miles an hour. So even though they would have sprung these guys at that point, they basically still had about a 2 hour trek down to the beach where the Catalpa's crew was going to meet them. So the good news was, again, with these work details, all of the men really had assignments on the next day, because what happened was Smith Anthony on Easter Sunday got in his longboat with his five crew members. He made it safely to shore and he was there overnight. And the next morning on Easter, on the day after Easter, was actually when the prisoners would actually leave their work details or bluff their way out of the prison and meet up with Breslin and Desmond.
Okay.
So basically the prisoners, the first prisoner, Wilson, was assigned to the prison chaplain. He just walked away from his work assignment because nobody was really paying any attention. Again, remember, these guys are 10,000 miles by sea from the British Isles. Nobody, 3,000 miles from Eastern Australia. So nobody was really looking over their shoulder during the day.
Mm-hmm.
The next two guys, prisoners Hassett and Cranston, basically were assigned to a work detail of digging potatoes in a nearby field. And once they got out of the prison, they basically kind of wandered away from that work detail, nobody really paying any attention. One of them went to the Fremantle jetty and told orderlies that another guy there, prisoner Harrington, was needed at the governor's house to move furniture. And the last guy, a convict named Morgan, was assigned to a painting detail. And once again, two of the other prisoners came by and said, hey, he's got another assignment. He also needs to move furniture. So at least in the short term, with everybody sort of half hung over from the day before, nobody really questioned any of this. And it was no time at all that all six of these prisoners met up with Breslin and Desmond at the intersection of the road from Fremantle to Rockingham, got in these carriages, and they started, you know, like as fast as they could go, heading towards the beach at Rockingham, assuming that George Smith Anthony would be there. And they had these two people kind of riding shotgun in front of them in case anybody started to come the other way or they ran into anything problematic. Now, not only did Breslin and Desmond have clothing for these folks, but they also had weapons because they had already planned ahead that should anybody try to stop them, they would shoot it out with them. And it kind of gave the idea of the gravity of this, because once it got to a point where Breslin and Desmond had these guys in a carriage, not only would the six convicts be, you know, severely dealt with, probably again hanged, but even Breslin and Desmond would have been in prison at that point.
Yeah, for sure.
And certainly the members of the crew also came with rifles and pistols, because had they also been picked up by the Australian Mounted Police, they certainly were also going to wind up in prison, at least in the short term. Mm-hmm. So again, it gives you an idea. This wasn't just an escape attempt. This was kind of a life or death situation,
sure,
not only for the prisoners, especially for the people who are coming to rescue them. Well, while this 2 hours is transpiring, George Smith Anthony unfortunately notices that while they had reconnoitered the spot, which seemed like an empty beach, he looked about a quarter mile down to the north towards Fremantle and Perth, and he noticed there was a jetty. Mm-hmm. And not only was there a jetty, there were men unloading what looked to be lumber on the jetty. He was so obvious on the beach with his longboat that the person supervising this kind of offloading of lumber came over and asked him what he was doing. And he said, well, I'm off a whaling ship and I basically need to replace an anchor that I lost in a recent storm. Well, the guy kind of laughed at him because he realized that was a pretty unlikely story, but he didn't really do anything. And he didn't really say anything. And Smith Anthony figured, well, maybe he's an ex-convict and he's not going to rat me out.
Sure.
But it was disconcerting because the last thing he said to George Smith Anthony was basically, hey, if you're hiding out, this isn't a good spot because the Georgette is going to be by here in a little while and it's going to pick me up and take me into Perth, which is kind of his way of letting Smith Anthony know that whatever you're up to, you know, I don't particularly care, but people on the Georgette might care and start asking you questions.
I would be shitting myself if that was me. I would just be like, oh, shit.
Yeah, and even worse is because the Georgette wasn't even a sailing vessel like the Catalpa, it moved really slowly, but it was a steamship. So Smith Anthony could see on the horizon the smoke from the Georgette, as it wasn't going to get there momentarily, but it was definitely going to get there in a relatively timely fashion. So he was really, you know, was under the gun as far as timing went. As this sort of is evolving, all of a sudden the first two men on horseback show up. And there was nothing in between the intersection of the Rockingham and Fremantle Road, luckily. But they told him the situation. They said, you better get those wagons here as quickly as possible. And so they even turned around, went back, and got Breslin and Desmond to speed up as much as possible. And within a few minutes, they got everybody into the longboat, and they started to try to make their way out into the surf, which, as you can well imagine, this longboat was only supposed to really hold about, at the most, 8 people.
Oh, sure.
And now you've got Desmond and Breslin, because they're not sticking around, because everybody's going to know after the escape that they had something to do with it.
Sure.
You have the 6 prisoners. You have Smith Anthony and the 5 sailors who came with him. So that's 14 people on a boat that's designed for the most 8, maybe 10 sailors.
Sure.
You know, the water is very close to the side of this longboat. They do put up the sail, but they had a real tough time getting off the beach. And they finally, when they got about a quarter to a half a mile off of the beach, fairly safely, however, all kinds of Royal Mounted Australian Police appeared right where they had been, fully aware. Somebody, either it was the guy on the jetty, or somebody figured out that there was a whole missing group of convicts, or somehow this group of Australian police showed up on the beach, even waded out into the water and started shooting at the Catalpa and the men in the longboat.
Jeez.
But they were too far away. They were a good half a mile off of the beach at that point. So everybody, the prisoners, are all excited. You know, it's like, hey, we got away from them. This should be, you know, the worst is over. Except, again, almost like a movie, the weather, Smith Anthony is starting to get pretty uptight because he could tell that the weather, which started the day off as fairly calm, was starting to build up. And just he had a feeling that was only going to get worse. And in fact, it did get worse. It got so bad that the Georgette actually did not pursue the longboat right away because the storm, this was sort of midday. Well, the storm hit this whole area at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the catalpa, the mast that it put up with the short sail on it, basically cracked.
Oh, geez.
That's how rough it was. And they had to spend literally not only the rest of that afternoon, but the rest of that night they were on the water, because the catalpa, based on the storm, really had to worry about getting being swept on shore onto, you know, shoals and reefs and that kind of thing.
Sure.
And they figured probably there's no way this longboat would possibly try to make it off the beach and stay out. You know, they probably were hiding somewhere, certainly not on the open water. And that's pretty much what the Georgette and everybody on the Australian side thought. But it wasn't as if the Australians let up, because the law enforcement, even the governor of that territory, issued a sort of an all points bulletin, and it read, "Detained by force, if necessary, American whaling bark catalpa, George Anthony Master. Arrest said Anthony, his officers and crew, and any passengers who may be aboard." Even though all night, and it did get pretty serious, the longboat did survive. I mean, there were points where they really thought that they were going to capsize.
Oh, yeah.
They could see in the distance the catalpa did put up beacon lights, possibly for them to even see. But because of the conditions, the catalpa actually kept even moving away from the longboat, and it was miles away. I mean, there was no way that they, in the night, really, they had to spend most of their time just making sure they didn't capsize.
That would be terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and remember, it's a long, the thing, with each passing wave, they figured this may be the one that tips this thing over.
Yeah.
And you're talking about being, you know, you're on the open ocean, 10 to 15 foot waves minimum, having no idea, you know, like, is this going to get better? Is this going to get worse? So they did survive, you know, dawn came up, the storm kind of passed. But the bad news then was they had to get onto the catalpa. They had to even find the catalpa, because at daybreak, they could sort of see it in the distance. But the one thing they realized right away was that there were two ships that basically had come looking for them. And the first one they could see was the Georgette. And the Georgette was making a beeline for the catalpa itself. Now, fortunately, the longboat was so small in the water that basically they couldn't see the longboat. They proceeded to steam up to the catalpa, that is the Georgette. The captain of the Georgette pulled right up to the catalpa and said, "We're going to board you to search for prisoners."
Oh, God.
And this guy, Sam Smith, who was the first mate, who was, again, the only person who initially had known of the initial voyage, he was a Scot, so he was kind of hostile to the British anyway to begin with. He said, "We're in international waters, and you can't board me." And, you know, there was an argument back and forth, and this guy, he was called the water police chief, so he was effectively like the highest ranking police official maritime in this particular region.
Sure.
And the problem he had with the Georgette as well, that they had spent basically that whole morning, they had left Fremantle at 9 o'clock the night before, and they had spent much of the night, even though there was a storm, they spent it trying to look for the longboat. So in the morning, by the time they found the catalpa, they basically, because they were operating on coal, they were running low on coal. So they literally, they figured, well, look, we probably can't board this thing anyway. We know there's no longboat, because he could tell that there was no longboat on the whaling ship. So we figured, well, the prisoners aren't on there. They're on the water somewhere. Let's head back to Fremantle. I got to get more coal anyway. And maybe we'll be able to see the longboat with all these prisoners on it, because there's no way the longboat could be out on the water all night. They would have capsized and sunk.
Sure.
That's how bad the weather had been. The other boat was a smaller, what they would call basically a police bark. It was a ship with a sail. It was much faster than the Georgette, but it didn't really have any weaponry. This guy Stone told the Georgette, "Keep an eye on the catalpa. I'll head back to shore and hopefully I'll find the prisoner somewhere between here, the ship, the catalpa, and where they're probably hiding on shore, somewhere in the water." Well, they didn't realize the longboat was close. And as soon as the Georgette steamed away, the men in the longboat had basically flags that they used to kind of signal to the catalpa that they were in the vicinity. And luckily, the catalpa picked up on that. Now, the smaller boat, the police boat that they left behind to keep an eye on the catalpa, also picked up on it. So it became a race between this longboat and this police boat, and the police boat certainly would have been able to detain the longboat, but because the Catalpa was also heading in their direction, they managed to get there first, get on board, and got safely on the deck before the police boat could do anything about it. So the date is now April 18th, 1876, and it's a little less than 1 year from the time that George Smith Anthony left New Bedford, Massachusetts. And the prisoners are on board the Catalpa. They figure that everything's fabulous and this is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And even though they had a rough day, they begin a wild celebration. George Smith Anthony is, he knows that basically there's no way he's in any shape to start sailing. So they just remain at anchor and the police boat basically sails away. Well, by the time the Georgette got to Fremantle, reloaded with coal, they figured, well, we're going to wait till tomorrow anyway. And we'll try to track down the Catalpa, which they could see, they could pretty much tell, had not left the vicinity. And the Georgette could catch up to the Catalpa, and they did. And so they went, they woke up George Smith Anthony really early on the next morning and basically told him, hey, here comes the Georgette. And the Georgette literally came within about 300 feet of the Catalpa. And at that point, this guy Stone starts yelling, now I know you have prisoners on board. I see your longboats on there. You basically have, you know, I'm going to board your ship. Mm-hmm. And Anthony's having none of it. And he just basically yells back to him, you know, the ship is sailing under the American flag. She's on the high seas. And Stone yells back to him, basically, that's not going to protect you, especially if you have illegal prisoners on board. I intend to board you. Now, a couple things to keep in mind, that the Catalpa's crew was armed, which they could see. They had rifles, sure. They had pistols. Now, the prisoners were not visible on deck, but there were probably a solid 25 sailors, all of them armed with rifles. The other thing they had was a harpoon gun.
Oh, yeah.
Which you can imagine was something that they would shoot, that they would propel into a whale to basically catch whales, and then they would get in the longboat and then harpoon the whale and then drag it on board. But you can imagine that a harpoon gun would pack quite the velocity if somebody sure. got any, you know, close to the ship. So between the harpoon gun and the fact that they were in international waters and Anthony had raised the American flag, Stone was kind of faced with quite the quandary.
Yeah.
He fired a warning shot over the bow of the Catalpa. And he said, I'm going to give you 15 minutes and I'm not even going to try to board you. I'm going to blast your ship, you know, to kingdom come. And so, of course, that great cinematic moment, George Smith Anthony says, if you fire on me, you are firing on the American flag.
Oh, yeah.
And Stone really didn't say much of anything other than you've got 15 minutes. And everybody sort of stared at each other. And then at this point, too, the Catalpa is fully rigged to sail. So the Catalpa is sailing away from the Georgette and getting even further and further into international waters. And in fact, it's actually picking up speed so that the Georgette is struggling almost to even keep up with it. And finally, the Georgette just stopped and basically turned around and went back. And that was basically the end of the confrontation. At this point, the prisoners all knew that at least at this moment, they had escaped from the Fremantle goal. And, you know, they were now free. There was only one problem. They had to sail 10,000 miles back to the United States. And if they ran across any other British ships, especially naval ships, you know, they were done for because they would have arrested sure. the whole crew with Anthony. So sure. to get back 10,000 miles, they had to interact with other ships and buy provisions from them and make sure they weren't British and not even really say very much other than the fact that they were whaling ships. But they did make it back to New York City on August 19th, 1876. And because they had communicated with other ships that got back to the United States earlier, the story broke in the New York newspapers that actually these convicts had been rescued. When the six men and Smith Anthony made it back first to New York, it was front page news all over the United States.
That's crazy.
There was still a lot of hostility to Great Britain because of what went on during the Civil War, because Great Britain was very sympathetic to the Confederacy because they wanted the cotton.
Sure.
We're in the midst of the Industrial Revolution and Britain did, you know, they figured, hey, we'll take cotton from anybody, even if they're an armed yep. rebellion against the U.S. government. So
sure.
there was a little bit of that going on. There was a lot of hostility from the Irish immigrant community that this was a real, you know, black eye for the British Navy and you know, the whole prison penal colony system in general. Again, it was front page news across America. And then when George Smith Anthony made it back to New Bedford, you know, he was greeted as a hero there and was immediately hired because he could never, of course, become a ship captain again, because anywhere he went, if he crossed paths with any British ship, he would have been arrested. So,
sure.
So basically, he was given almost an honorary sinecure as a customs inspector. And he spent the rest of his life basically as a very respected but very well-paid customs inspector. And he did get a large portion of the spoils, not only of the catalpa, of all the whaling stuff, that, you know, the money they were paid for all of the materials that they got whaling. He and two other people were able to sell the ship and get paid fairly handsomely from that as well. So he not only made out economically, he was a hero in New Bedford for the rest of his life, where he lived pretty uneventfully. 1913, died at the age of 69. All of the six other prisoners settled either in New York or New England. And again, you know, some of them didn't live very long because they had been in prison under harsh conditions. Some of them lived into the 20th century. But they all lived relatively obscure lives after that, this really being the highlight of their lives. And also Smith Anthony's probably the wildest thing that he ever did. That's the story of the SS Catalpa and George Smith Anthony.
I can't imagine how stressed out isn't even like the right verbiage, but how just like you would be in this almost constant state of fear for how many months? It was from like mid-April to August. Like, that's a long time to be looking over your shoulder.
And, you know, like at that point, especially if they got caught on the high seas, it was no mercy, no quarter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were all, it would have probably taken quite a negotiation, but certainly, you know, the prisoners would have, at that point, maybe they would have been hanged. By the way, a lot of the crew members probably were not even American citizens. And
sure.
You know, they came from all kinds of very diverse backgrounds. And so who knows, you know, based on their nationality, they may have gone to lengthy prison sentences as well. So
sure.
You're exactly right. I mean, and again, it almost seems in telling of the story that, you know, yeah, everything went off and I guess it really wasn't as complex or as difficult as it sounded. But again, you're dealing with, there's no way to really communicate for months at a time. And
mm-hmm.
All this stuff had to fall in place. And there was always the suspicion that there was going to be some kind of attempt to get these guys out of jail. So it really is, it kind of is not only quite exciting, but really nothing short of miraculous.
Yeah, it was almost like a comedy of errors that still somehow worked out. Like all these things kept popping up, you know, like being discovered on the beach and then the sail breaks and they're stuck in the water all night. And, you know, like all these things kept happening. And then, you know, they're still able to get away with it. You know, like it's incredible.
Well, we were talking a little bit about history and, you know, and a lot of things, it's kind of like D-Day where, you know, the weather only had a 48-hour window for the D-Day invasion to take place because the weather was so horrible, and yet it played kind of to their advantage because, you know, the Germans on shore figured nobody's ever going to even bother to try to invade during this time period.
Sure.
So some of the stuff kind of worked to their advantage, you know, even though at the end of the day, it caused some terrible anxiety during
mm-hmm.
the course of this whole crazy. The other guy that had to flee almost immediately because there was a lot of suspicion was the Irish priest also had to make his way to the United States, which he eventually did, because after this, not only was there jubilation in, you know, the U.S. and the Irish community, but in Australia, there were a lot of long faces after this event, because again, it was a real black eye for the Fremantle goal and the people running it.
Oh, I can imagine. I totally forgot about him. Yeah, I'd be hightailing it out of there too, if I was him.
Yep.
Yeah.
He sort of did a who me for a little while, but you know, things got a little unpleasant for him. So he finally figured out, better get out of town while the getting is good. That's what he did.
Yeah. I'd be like, what are some whaling ships that I can pay my way on? Because I need to get out of here.
Exactly.
That's awesome. I had never heard this story before. And I know like a little bit about the penal colony on Australia. I mean, you'd hear about it here and there on various history podcasts and things like that. But I guess I had never really thought about the conditions that the prisoners had to be in. Like the size, when you said the size of the cells, like that's so small. And
yeah.
The fact that they had to do like manual labor and things like that. So it's like, not only are you in probably horrible conditions, because I'm sure they didn't like give them five-star treatment as far as heat and air conditioning and all that fun stuff. But, you know, to work hard all day and then go back to that, that's rough.
Well, I think I mentioned in the beginning that a letter got smuggled out by the Irish priest to the Irish community, which really was the impetus for the whole the event itself, and really motivated them to do something. Because in it, one of the prisoners wrote to them. He basically described their conditions as a living tomb, and the idea that they, you know, the British were never going to let them go, and they were going to die there probably fairly quickly. And you know, you're correct that yeah, they got to move around and all, but they really were treated pretty harshly.
It's almost at that point, even though yes, they were able to get out and farm and go to church and things like that. But again, like the threat of what you could face if you tried to escape almost certain death, would it even be worth it at that point to even try? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep.
Because who's going to help you?
Yeah. Until somebody came up with this kind of ingenuity, it was like the perfect prison. It's like, go ahead, try to traverse 3,000 miles of Australian outback with no water, really. See how far you get. You know, we'll stand back and laugh, you know, before we drag you back.
And this is people from an entirely different continent who would have no idea how to even navigate the Australian outback without even factoring in like the wildlife and the temperature and all that fun stuff. Like, yeah, you wouldn't get very far at all.
And the heat, I mean, you know, that part of Australia gets incredibly hot, you know, especially in the summertime, or their summertime, which is our winter time. But
yeah,
it was a very kind of fundamentally brutal yet ingenious kind of punishment, you know, for people that would be taken completely out of their element. I think for the British too, Australia at that point was such a, they kind of didn't know what to do with it. And certainly not a whole lot of people wanted to settle there. So it was,
sure.
By the 1870s and 1880s, things were changing. But, you know, in the mid part of the 19th century, it was like, hey, somebody's got to settle this place. You know, perfect. Let's just send these
there. Yep.
You know, they can, and while they're at it, they can do all the dirty work for us too, you know?
Yep, exactly. Well, I really appreciate you coming on and telling this story, Philip. It was fascinating hearing this jailbreak story. And again, something that I'd never heard of before. And it kind of reminds me of almost like the Shawshank Redemption type of thing. Like there were so many moving pieces, but at the same time, it still like miraculously worked out. It was so involved, like with coordinating the carriages and people on the horses that were running ahead and all these moving pieces, that if one of those things failed, you know, like the whole thing would fall apart.
Well, and then the other, like the quandary that you might have gotten into, like think about it, like let's say one of the convicts wasn't able to get there.
Yeah.
You know, and so then what do they do? And the answer, by the way, they had a predetermined answer, and the answer was they were going to wait a little while, but then they were just going to go.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it was kind of now or never, but luckily again, that didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about you or your podcast or anything really that you'd like to plug for our listeners?
Well, you know, I appreciate that. And again, I do have a website at someveryfamouspeople.com. You know, of course you can get my podcast through the usual channels, but it's also, all of them are kind of listenable through the actual website itself. And there's other information about me. You know, I've written some journalism and made a documentary film. And of course, you can scroll pretty quickly through all of the other subjects. This was actually one of the first podcasts I ever did. But, you know, there's all kinds of things that are obscure like this, but also people that, the idea being, I take that, even though it's a person you may have heard of, I take that 700-page book, you know, doorstop size thing that you'll never read. I kind of reduce it to about an hour. So if you like history, but again, it's harder and harder to really devote the time necessary to both the research and even the reading of biographies and also thick books about any type of historic events, I kind of do you a favor and shrink it down to sort of the most essential parts in a way that's pretty entertaining.
Well, again, thank you so much, Philip. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today. And on that note, as always, I'm Lindsay, and I'll see you next time with another tale as old as crime.
Got something you want to say? Shoot us an email over at yieldcrimepodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your story ideas, see any gifts you send our way, or if you just want to say hello. We're pretty friendly. Speaking of friendly, if you'd like to have real-time conversations with us, consider joining our Discord over at the Cultivate Network. You can chat with us over at the Old Crimers Cubby, or catch up with any of the other great creators that are part of the Cultivate family of podcasts. Just click the link in our show notes or over on our link tree to get started today. Looking for more content? You can find us online at yieldcrimepodcast.com. If you'd like to see pictures from this week's episode, not to mention bonus content and funny memes, make sure to follow us on Twitter at yieldcrimepod and on Facebook and Instagram at yieldcrimepodcast. On TikTok? Of course you are. Follow us at yieldcrimepodcast. If you're interested in ad-free content, consider supporting us with a one-time donation either over on Buy Me a Coffee or our Venmo page, both of which are in our link tree and in the show notes. If you'd like early ad-free content, not to mention some bonus material, become a member of our Patreon today for as low as $1 a month. If you want a playlist of all our episodes on YouTube, click the link in our show notes or in our link tree and subscribe today for not only a list of our full catalog, but a separate list as well, just of our Can You Crack the Crampboard segments.